Thank you for joining us for this episode of ZB Talk, a production of the Zeta Beta Tau Foundation.
This podcast was created to highlight some of the many amazing stories about the brothers of Zeta Beta Tau fraternity.
We, the brothers of Zeta Beta Tau fraternity, believe that the development of the individual as a responsible, mature member of society is the primary goal of the university today.
We believe that fraternity offers to the university community a unique, desirable, and successful means of achieving this goal.
In fulfilling the purposes of fraternity, we dedicate ourselves to the principles of intellectual awareness, social responsibility, integrity, and brotherly love.
What's the hour?
It must be time for ZB Talk. This is Farron Lewitt, Psi University of Alabama, 1997.
And Jonathan H. Levin, Alpha Kappa, University of Wisconsin, 2002.
We're your hosts for this episode of ZB Talk. With us today is Brother Larry Flax, Alpha Mu, University of Washington, 1964, who's the co-founder of California Pizza Kitchen.
Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Thanks for having me.
You were also with us at the 2018 ZBT convention, where you stated that since your graduation, you haven't always been involved with ZBT, but you made a point of saying that ZBT has always been involved with you. What did you mean by that?
Well, it struck me, you know, I was being honored, of course, at that convention, and that was really terrific, but I also know that I've not been the most active person since leaving in 64, but I was trying to make the point to the people at the convention that, well, I haven't been active in ZBT. That does not mean ZBT has not been active in me. And I was trying to express what I experienced at ZBT to become a part of them and to become part of me in a lot of different ways. But basically, the idea of, you can call it brotherhood, but the truth of the matter is, when you're involved in business or dealing with people, you may not call them brothers or sisters or whatever, but it's your relationship with those people that make you or break you. You're either good at it or you're not. You're either good at assessing people and neutralizing the people that you may not get along with, but get along with them, learning how to get along with people. And never show your cards, never let people understand how you really feel, but basically understand their qualities and their abilities to help you along the way, even though they may not become your best friends, but you are involved with them at that period of time. And so it's learning about what teamwork is really all about. I don't suspect people, when you take a football team, suspect that everybody on the football team loves each other. But I bet you they love working with each other. And being involved in a fraternity life is such a 3-4 years of learning how to get along and deal with all sorts of people, from the people you really get close to and care for, and also those who you don't get close to and care for, but you are still part of the family. And you use that experience to make it work. And the most, the best brothers are the ones that really do want to make it work. And that carries on in life. From the very minute you leave, and I certainly left Washington and back to Los Angeles, those qualities just carried on. I just have always felt that my best quality was, in terms of leadership, was to assess my relationship with other people and always get along with them. I mean, my theory is never make an enemy. The enemies that you make sometimes will surprise you later in life when they come back and hurt you, but the friends you make will come back and feed you. And ZBT is nurturing zone at a very formidable age, 18 to 21. when you, those qualities are born. And so when I said that statement, yeah, I didn't stay involved with the organization of ZBT other than, with some donation and things like that, but not actively, like all the people in the room that night were very actively involved. I was just being honored. But that's what my point was. My point was, I may not be active with ZBT, but ZBT is active in me.
Wonderful.
And speaking of family and brothers, did you grow up with any brothers or sisters?
A sister, who I'm very close with, 6 years apart.
Oh, great. That's great. And what was your childhood like?
Oh, my childhood was, I guess middle class, Los Angeles. It's kind of funny how you look at back at your childhood. I guess we weren't very wealthy, but I always thought we were. One of those things, I think, just to go with Pat and think they're rich. But my parents were wonderful. My sister and I had a great relationship. And, so my childhood, I would say, was very happy. Other than my high school days, I was very average. In fact, I graduated with a 2.7 grade point average from high school, which was exactly the mean grade point average of my high school class. I was neither fish nor fowl in my mind. I never, in my head, very popular, but neither was I unpopular. I just sort of rode the middle rail. And when I left Los Angeles and went up to the University of Washington and joined ZBT, everything changed. Nobody knew me. I could reinvent myself. I could be whoever I wanted to be, and people didn't know if I was popular, unpopular, anything. I just could reinvent myself and did.
And so how did you end up at the University of Washington coming from L.A.?
Well, my cousin was very close with Steve Ball. I was pretty well known because his dad had a Fox and Gem shop up in Seattle. He was, at that time, he's 2 years older than me, but he was president of the Interfraternity Council. And we were very close. I had another cousin, like a brother, that was him. And he convinced me to come up to school and join him there. And I did. And it was quite an experience because I went from going to Hamilton High School, where it was like 90% Jewish, to University of Washington, which was anything but. And I actually learned a little bit about anti-Semitism and learned that, I never realized I was in a minority. I mean, I never focused on it at high school, but I certainly did at the University of Washington. But joining ZBT was really a terrific experience in terms of adapting to being with a group of Jewish men in a not majority Jewish atmosphere. And it was interesting to assimilate and to learn how to deal in that kind of a situation. Very interesting. And I learned a lot about being in a minority.
So what was the greatest lesson that Alpha Mu ZBT taught you?
The greatest lesson? well, I guess what I just referred to. When I first got up there, I was startled to learn, that the ZBT house was, wasn't just a fraternity house, it was a Jewish house. It was us and the Salmons. And then you had all the other fraternities and sororities, but learned how to assimilate and make really great friends out of the people from the other houses and really became ambassadors, a lot of us, to assimilating us being Jewish into a primarily a non-Jewish atmosphere. In fact, I became a manager for one of my friends running for student body president, Larry Newton. And he became a close second in the school. And that was big. It was a big school. And we really prided ourselves in assimilating and learning how to become friends. We taught a lot of people who didn't know much about the Jewish people. In fact, my first girlfriend had never met a Jew, in her life. And it was really, I don't know how many other chapters have that experience that we had at University of Washington. But it is so much that we carried through. Because when I came back to LA, of course, I was back in the circles that I've always known. But it surely taught me about what anti-Semitism is and how to assimilate it, how to dissemble it. So in a strange way, that may have hit home more for me than anybody else, because I wasn't used to it, you know. And made it my goal to I made it my goal to dissimulate and become really good friends with a lot of different people. And I remember when I went to Rushwick, Rushwick at the University of Washington, where she went to parties at various houses. You selected the house. They didn't select you. You picked the house, and then they had rush party. And I remember going to a party at one of the attorney houses, and my cousin gave me the list. I was always going to be a ZBT. I really wasn't shopping, but you still had to go to a number of the parties. And he gave me the list of the big men on campus attorneys. He wanted me to meet everybody. You know, he had already assimilated. He was president of, a Jewish guy president of the American Fraternity Council. So he set me up with what he considered to be the top attorneys. I remember I went into one, I won't mention the name, and they greeted me at the door and they assigned me a guy, and he sort of walked me to the side and says, look, and he says, let me just tell you something straight. He says, there's no way we're ever going to invite you to be a member of this fraternity. And maybe what you'd like to do, CBT is having their party tonight too, maybe you'd like to go up the street to the ZBT party. Now that was my very first experience with anti-Semitism. That hit like a ton of bricks. And I remember looking the guy in the eye and I said, well, I told him a story about my cousin and why they were so, I was there. And I said, so if you don't mind, unless you're ready to show me your kitchen and the ovens, let's let me get to know you. That guy became one of my best friends, closest friends at the University of Washington. That very guy who was inviting me to read the fraternities. I never was going to get in. That probably stayed with me forever because he was so wrong. And I showed him he was so wrong.
Interesting. Well, tell us about the chapter and your chapter brothers that you maintain contact with over the years.
Well, one, unfortunately, which I made known at that conference talking about, when he was very close, was Jeff Propp, who passed away, you know, right before I think their convention. And he was a CEO of, and chairman and founder of Costco. And we stayed close. Larry Lee, the guy that ran for student body president, is still very close to talk to him 2 days ago, 3 days ago. In fact, he had come down with the virus and beat it. Howard Rose, who Elton John and Jimmy Buffett's manager, we're still close. Right now, that would be Mo Muscatel, who's my cousin, who was a member of the class. We're still close. But you know what? Anybody, any one of them could call me anytime for anything. And I would respond. I mean, you can be close and not be in contact. And then anybody that's in the chapters now, I think, will understand that feeling. Is you sort of know that with most of the brothers that you have, they called you 20, 30, now it's been so many more years, and they needed something and they reached out, you would not hang up on them.
The success of your Alpha Mu brothers from your generation, from your time in the chapter, is pretty remarkable by any measure. Curious is, what do you attribute to the success to? Because there's a number of guys, I mean, yourself included, Jeff Brotman and others, that really made it to the pinnacle of their particular industry or profession. Anything that you can comment on relative to just how that group of guys ended up all having that similar quality?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're talking about, I'll bet you could almost go and interview somebody from almost any class of any school, you know, and I think that there'll always be these examples you know, let's face it, there's millions of very successful people that are around. And whether it's law or being a doctor, being a, entrepreneur, they will be able to point to their successes. I don't know that my class is any different. I think you have some pretty good examples of success, but I would be willing to bet you could almost interview, people from any of the chapters after a number of years, and they'll point to people, look at, I learned at that convention, some of these people you honored were wildly successful at what they did, and they weren't alpha mutants. So I don't know. I think we had a group of interesting people, and they found success in different ways. Like Larry Levy, for instance, is a very successful mediator. Right? He's retired now, but he went into law and became a successful mediator. Now, Jeff Brodmann went into law and then went into oil. And I remember he didn't do it all that well. And then he stumbled upon this Costco idea, which obviously hit. Doesn't mean they didn't have their failures, too. I failed at the restaurant business first time I ever tried it, too. So I just think my bet would be you could interview anybody in any of the chapters at a certain age, and you'd be able to quote roll off some real successful people that might startle you. You discover them all the time.
Sure.
Rattling off to me, oh, this person was a CBT, and this person, I'm always astounded.
Sure. Speaking of success, I know early in your career, you served in the United States Attorney's Office as an assistant attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice, and then started your own law firm. Curious how you transitioned from law to pizza. It seems like an obvious transition, and I would love to know about it.
Well, it's obvious, I guess. Well, when, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, met my law partner and my partner in pizza business. And in 1973, we formed a private practice. I went a little bit earlier than him, and we formed our law partnership, Fox and Rosenfield, which specialized in white collar criminal. That's what we did with the U.S. Attorney's Office. We did mainly white collar crime. And it was very fascinating. We traveled all over the country and, because federal work can be anywhere. It wasn't like just here in a state court. We'd be in federal courts all over the country, and basically we'd be doing grand jury work. In other words, people would hire us when they were under investigation. Interesting about federal crimes, it's mostly people know before they get arrested, they're, in terms of our clientele, that they're under investigation and came to us to stop from being prosecuted. We're pretty good at it. But it went on for, let's see, we opened the restaurant, we started in 84 to work for it, and we opened five. So, about 11 years of doing that kind of work, traveling all over the country, and we even got, like I say, we got enamored of the restaurant business more on a social basis, because there was a restaurant here in LA that was very popular that we got involved with the owners, and so we took a partnership interest in. Very, very popular. I mean, you just get all the stars, and Sally Struthers was very much involved at the time when she was really being her TV show. And then, at one point, if I recall, we had three of the four Beatles in the restaurant. But our problem was, is Rick and I were mainly still practicing law, and we were both single, and we couldn't resist picking up everybody's tab. But the thing you learn at the restaurant business is stop buying everybody everything. You let them pay. We couldn't resist in big shots like that. So the restaurant margins fell, and eventually it closed. But we kept our law practice. We never stopped practicing law again. And we always loved the business. It was really fun. And so we always had it in our minds that we wanted to go back into it, where we really controlled it, do it smart. And eventually we came up with this idea for California Pizza Kitchen, which didn't even have a name when we came up with it. In our heads, it was Pizza Place Making Wood Burning. You notice the wood burning oven that Spago, Wolfgang Puckett put in Spago, and Alice Waters really started. We actually got the idea from Alice Waters, Jay Panisse. She actually built a brick oven, and so did he. And but it was getting all the, you know, all the press, all the stars would go to Wolfgang Puck and eat the duck sauces pizza. And they picked, this star was eating the duck sauce pizza. And this star was eating the duck sauce pizza. So it got a lot of press. I think, you know, that really made Spago very hot. You always say Alice Waters perfected California, or invented California style pizza. Wolfgang Puck made it famous, and we capitalized on it. Because what we saw was nobody could get into Spago unless you knew the guy at the door. And every once in a while, we knew a friend or a client got us in. But you knew the majority of people really wanted to eat that pizza, but couldn't get there. So we said, well, what if we bring it down to the street level, you know? And so we designed a restaurant, very small, with a counter around the oven, and it was only 90 seats in total. I remember that was with the patio. And our Beverly Drive is still there, first restaurant. And at that time, we didn't have a name. We just knew we were going to do these kinds of pizza. And we were designing it and building it. And we raised money. I won't go into the whole story of financials, but that's an interesting story for another day. But at any rate, we're getting close to opening. We still have a name. I wake up at 3:30 in the morning, and I knew it in my heart that California Pizza Kitchen should be the name. And I even knew it should be CPK. And the reason I like the CPK, which was put in the logo, look at our original logo, the little CPK in the very bottom corner of it. And the reason is when I was in high school, a lot of people thought it was because of Kentucky Fried Chicken, but it wasn't because of KFC at all. It didn't come to my mind. What it was is when I was in high school, we used to have a drugstore where the Beverly Roosevelt Hotel was at called MFK's, No Meth Christ. And everybody after their dates or whatever, you know, late at night, we all congregated, we go 24 an hour, we congregated at MFK's, with, you know, a fountain. That was in my head, I swear. And that's why I wanted people to be saying, let's go to CPK. Not because of Kentucky Fried Chicken, but because of Milton F. Christ. So that's the story of how that came about. But so I woke up at 3:30 in the morning, and I knew it should be California Pizza. We had never discussed the name before. So I called Rick, it's only happened one other time in my life. He called me to ask to meet at a deli at 6 o'clock in the morning. And the reason was he wanted, you know, it's okay to marry his wife. He thought it might bless him. But we were solid single buddies. I mean, we were really close and single. And I did give my blessing. I love his wife. And so this was the second time in our life that I called him. I waited till 5 something. I called him and said, you got to meet me. We met Nate Nels in Beverly Hills. He said, why did you bring him? I said, I named the restaurant. He said, would you name the restaurant? I said, absolutely. He said, well, what is it? I said, California Pizza Kitchen. He said, that is the worst name I ever heard. He really broke my heart. But that night, we went out to dinner with a friend of ours and a couple from Providence, Rhode Island that had come to visit his friend. And we said we were opening this pizza place on South Beverly Drive, and told them, you know, what it was and the concept around the pizza oven in the front. And then we said, and we have some names. So without leading them, we rattled off the names we were looking at. One was Chow, one was Delore, and there was another Italian name. And then we, without giving them a clue, we said, and California Pizza Group. He said, is there any name that appeals to you? I said, oh, God, yes. The two of them, man and a woman. And they said, absolutely California Pizza. And he said, why? And I said, well, the others are just the Italian restaurants. We get to them sooner or later. But we really want to see what somebody that named a restaurant California Pizza Kitchen was all about. So we'd have to see that. And that's it. And that got into Rick's head. And then I said to Rick, I said, okay. We don't name it California Pizza Kitchen. and somebody else comes to compete with us, and they do, how are you going to feel? He thought about that and says, you're right, he's California. And that's the true story of the name of California Pizza.
Yeah, so what was the most challenging thing about your time at CPK?
Well, there's always challenges. People. The first thing you learn in a restaurant, is a group of people serving people. It's a very much part of the entertainment business. It's sort of, like having a play with a cast and an audience. And you really have to get the people motivated to give the audience their experience. And it wasn't so about, we really always try to figure that out. And try to, I think we were pretty good at getting leadership into the original restaurants. But as we grew, we realized you had to transfer that into other people. Now, there were other people, like I had a director in Atlanta. How did I know they were teaching everybody our philosophy of dealing with the people? Quality was always important, of course, but the people were really important. And when I said the people, it wasn't just about the customer. We needed a methodology of really translating who we were to our staff, to our front and back of the house. And that a lot of people don't pay attention to one or the other. They think back of the house more important, front of the house more important. To me, it's like the offense and defense. You need both working in harmony together. Truth of the matter is that about the seventh, seventh view of our directors from around the country, and it wasn't that many. I was sitting with a guy, and I was throwing around an acronym, and I came up with ROC. I wanted an acronym for our people. I came up with ROC, and it's good for respect, opportunity, communication, kindness. Each one of those, I swear I could do a 2-hour discussion, each one of those words, in terms of not our relationship to our customer, but our relationship to our team members, our staff. And I mean, the first one, respect, was really important to get the respect in front of the background. Well, that was the first hurdle. Always to be able to show the opportunity of growth. You have to keep growing and show people grow. You go from a host to a server to a restaurant manager to a back of the house person to a district director to a vice president. All the time we keep growing the restaurant, our challenge is to keep that opportunity going. Communication is vital between us. We had to keep talking to each other, not at each other. It's really important. I was always there. No one ever called me a mister. There's no mystery in California. To this day, there's no mysteries in California. Only name, first name. And then kindness, ultimately the glue of everything. I wanted kind people, people that really cared, people cared, that made the food, really wanted that food to taste good the person who got it. People that served it really became part of the experience of the people at the table. It became friends with the people at the table. And that was really important. I learned a lesson. When we opened the Mirage Hotel from Steve Wynn. In the Mirage Hotel, we used to put name tags on our people. And they always thought it was so people could identify them wrongly. Really, but people could identify them rightly. But he taught me how to let people put locations on their name tags, where they are from, or, where they want to be. And he didn't care. He just wanted a location. So now I'll never forget how the real testing that was. I went to Indianapolis for opening of a restaurant, and we had a server, a beautiful Indian girl. I noticed she had on her name, it was a Indian name, but Dahlia, and just she had Indianapolis on her name tag. And I asked her, I said, "Are you from Indianapolis?" She said, "No, I'm from Nepal." I said, "I'm going to try to make you better." I said, "Go back and get your name tag changed and put Nepal on it. And then in a month, I'm going to call you and ask you how your tips have gone." And I did. And I said, "I bet your tips went up 10%. And she said, "No, they went up 20%. Because as soon as people saw Nepal, immediately wanted to talk to her about about her being from Nepal. And it just was an icebreaker for the table. Then they were her friend, and they wanted to reward her. And that's what I want from my staff, to become involved with your tables, to be liked by them. And so, you know, it's all part of rock, but that, I don't know if that answered the original question, because I tend to wander.
No, that's great. That's great. I mean, you obviously built up with the help of Rock and your staff and people around you a wonderful company. And I know there's an interesting story on the sale. Just if you can, in a minute or two, give a quick rundown on the sale, if that's even possible to do in a couple of minutes.
But you're interested in when the first sale of CPK was not was to Pepsi. Other than we took investors. All along as we grew, we had a corporation, not a public corporation, but we would sell stock whenever we needed money to open restaurants, and we always sort of adjusted the stock price to what we thought it was worth. We sort of dictated that. You know, sometimes we used to joke and put our green visors on and go into our office with a dartboard, throw a dart to come up with what it was worth at our next round. But and that wasn't too far from what we did it, but. But the idea was we always trying to figure out what a valuation would be. And we always gave a big valuation. But people kept buying the stock. And the beauty of the thing was we never froze anybody in the stock. If you wanted to sell your stock, then you come to us and say, look, I need money, I need to get out. We find a buyer for you at the last price. We never took commission, we never made any money on it. We would just match you with the potential buyer. So over the year, until we got about 27 restaurants, we got up to 300 stockholders. And our lawyer said, well, you've got too many stockholders, and the SEC is going to come knocking at you, so you better go public. So we hired Skadden Arps and started to invest in going public. Well, one day we get a call from the guy. He said, guy with some stats. And he said, would you be interested in taking a meeting with the Fortune 100 company? He said, yeah, why not? You didn't hurt to take a meeting. And he wouldn't tell us the company until we agreed. We sort of figured it might be Pepsi because Pepsi was in the restaurant business. They had Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, KFC, and they had just acquired Chevy's and Eastside Mario. So we knew that. So we guessed that. Turned out we were right. So they flew us back to back to Purchase, New York, is where Pepsi is located. Beautiful campus. And we met with the CEO at that time. Terrific guy. And then first they overwhelmed us with a dinner at his house, Wayne Calloway. Wonderful guy. So first time I'd ever been served by butlers. First time experience. And that was a dinner on our arrival. Then the next day, they took us to the offices of Purchase, and the driver actually was able to pull up through the front door. He said, nobody ever gets to pull up through the front door. Everybody has to stop at this point back a ways and walk. He said, you're the first two people I've ever driven to the front door. So we go in and we have this meeting with a group of lawyers and vice presidents, and they want to buy half the company. And we only wanted to sell half the company because we wanted to stay. Part of the charm of going public is we got to stay as CEOs and we own a lot of stock. So our deal was to keep half the company and stay as CEO. They were okay with that. Now we had to settle on the price for the company. Well, it just so happened I didn't have a clue. But before we left, I had lunch with a friend of mine who was a big realtor, a very big owner of real estate. And I said, you know, we're going back to Pepsi to need to sell the company, but I really don't know how to value the company. This is, you know, not like us going public, but sort of you get a lot of help from bankers and figure out a price and they jump along. So we didn't really have a clue. He said, well, I said, Larry, I really don't know how to value a restaurant company. He said, I'll tell you something. He says, in Los Angeles, and this was 1992, he said, in Los Angeles, you aren't considered wealthy unless you have $10 million in the bank after tax. So I go back and I tell my partner the story. So my partner's good with numbers. on the back of an envelope, he does the computation for both of us to end up with $10 million and half the company, and comes up with a $140 million valuation for the entire entity, meaning $70 million to us and our stockholders for half the company. And we quoted that. We said, well, what we want is a $140 million valuation, meaning $70 million to us. And we looked around the table. These people, eyes dropped. They were not expecting anything like this. And they fought us for 2 days on that. We never left it. Never left it for an inch. We didn't know how to leave it, to be honest about it. But they argued that it was ridiculous. It had no bearing to anything you're making, and anything like that, too. And our attitude was really, I look back now, it must have felt great months. Our attitude was, look at it. You came to us. If you don't want it, thank you for the trip. You know, it was great. You know, but that's what we want. And for 2 days, we fought. But we didn't really fight. We just listened and kept saying the valuation. Finally, they came and they gave it to us. They had to prepare all the paperwork in order to get it. So we flew to Ireland with Steve Garvey and a group of people. And then we were flying back to go to purchase to sign the papers. And nobody knew in the company anything about this. Complete secret. So we had sort of a celebratory golf outing in Ireland. We flew back and we arrived at come to the meeting and for the signing. And they said, gee, we're sorry, the papers aren't ready yet. And they saw our jaws drop, you know, because we were worried they were back out on the deal, because in the meantime, the rest of the industry sort of collapsed a little bit. They said, and they laughed, and they said, but don't worry, we already wired $70 million to your bank. We know you'll sign. They were right. But the joke of it is, this, all of a sudden, our bank gets hit with a $70 million wire transfer with no knowledge of where it's coming from or why. So they were going crazy. So we had to tell them what happened. And then we signed the next day.
That was the first one.
The first sale. The second sale. How many sales do you want to go through?
Let's go through two. Do the quick 30 second.
Well, the second one was Pepsi decided in 1996 to get out of the restaurant business, the full service for sure. And then eventually they spun off to Yum. Their intent was to get out of the restaurant business. We had smelled that out a little bit because it's a discussion that we're having about restaurant business being too capital intensive and not enough margin compared to salty snack and bottled beverage. And so we had just signed and fought for 2 months. They wanted to renew our contract, 5-year contract, and they wanted to take control of the company, which we didn't mind because they had invested another $100 million in the company. And we trusted them. But we wanted to continue the agreement that sold the company. We had to approve it. And they fought us for 2 months on that. And we finally gave in. Then 2 months later, a guy by the name of Cisneros in Venezuela, who was the bottler, very wealthy in Venezuela, came to purchase and negotiate his contract. And evidently, because of some falling out on the contract, if he went back and changed overnight, on the midnight of the night, his contract expired with Pepsi, changed all of his trucks, and Venezuela went from Pepsi to Coca-Cola. Now, Pepsi's always been in competition with Coca-Cola, and that was a big hit to their stock, especially because everything was very much paying attention to foreign markets. And they took about a 10-point hit on $1.6 billion shares of stock. And so they then had to come up with this strategy, which was to spin off to Yum. First thing they had to do was sell us. And so we get a call from the restaurant news. This restaurant news one day from the reporter says that Roger Enrico, who's then chairman of Pepsi, has just announced they're going to sell off California Pizza. And we knew they couldn't. We said, we'll get back to you, but we knew something was wrong. So we called our contact at Pepsi. And so what's going on here? He said, wait, you're going to get a telephone call. Sure enough, about 10 minutes later, the phone rings, and it's a guy by the name of Chaz Phillips from Gleacher Company. He says, I've been assigned by Pepsi to handle your sale, or the sale of Pepsi's interest in CPK. He said, whoa, wait a minute. He said, no, please, you wait 1 second. I heard about you guys. But he said, congratulations, I'm sorry, exactly the word, you won the lottery. And the reason was it had to be a three-pronged sale, the buyer, Pepsi, and us. All three had to agree. So we could dictate, as well as any of the other two, the terms of the deal. And we drove a really hard deal. If you think the first deal was hard, this one was much tougher, much more beneficial to us. Because when the smoke cleared, the company wrote off $100 million in debt. We did not lose any equity. We were not diluted at all. And we picked up another $14 million for us and our shareholders. That's too much. And we went on with a brand new company and a brand new partner. That's the second sale.
Wonderful story. So you have a lot, obviously, to be proud of. So I'm interested in learning what you're most proud of.
What I'm most proud of is my grandchildren. I mean, you can't, that question is loaded.
Sure.
You could say most proud of the business, most proud of the family. You know, family always comes first, doesn't it? I mean, you get down to the final, the kids and the grandkids. You know.
Absolutely.
In business, it was growing that company to the very end and selling them. Remember, we finally did a final sale in 2011. And that was when we finally sold out completely. And not that I was most proud, but at that point, I was really proud of what we had done. And to this day, I still am. CBK is still, you know, it's one of those companies that, even though it's going through some restructuring right now, it's perfectly lined up for the new economy. It's really got all the basics for family and a bar and open spaces. Most of them are pretty big. I think it's going to do very well going forward. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud of having been the founder of CBK.
So, Larry, what haven't you done that you still want to do?
Oh, God. What haven't I done? I guess do something really important in philanthropy, something important. I do make donations and supported research projects and stuff. But somewhere out there, I still think there's some real impact for philanthropy. I basically think philanthropy is the unsung hero of the new economy. Not enough attention is spent to the amount of money that is spent in the United States yearly or donated yearly. Think collectively in the United States, it really set up very high, even government contributions.
So speaking of philanthropy, if I asked you a year ago or 6 months ago, what problem or issue you would solve if you had the resources, the knowledge, the ability to do so, what problem would it be and why? What would you say?
If I could solve it, which I don't think I can, I would like to, you know, the old song, bringing the world together to sing. I think our biggest problem is it's not even disease, it's world relationships. It's getting the world to come together. To me, it's so stupid that the world can't figure out how to bring itself together. How leaders can't join together and figure out how to do the common good, how to make it all work. Now, I don't know that I have an answer to that, but I criticize it a lot. I know that. That astounds me, absolutely astounds me, that we can't figure out how to put this world together. All the thousands of years of experience and history we've had, and all the failures that it's saying you have to learn from. But that, if I could do it, I would love to figure that formula out.
What motivates you, Larry?
What motivates me? The fact that the truth is, what I've learned in this life, you just never know what tomorrow will bring. You never know. You never know what corner you're going to turn, decision you're going to make, and what the impact will be. I look back at everything I've ever done and how it's happened and why it's happened and the fact that it almost didn't happen. Almost. Everything almost didn't happen. And so to me, it's always astounding that every day brings a new corner you can turn. So I'm looking forward, even at 77, for a few more corners to turn.
Wonderful. And obviously in today's times, looking forward to tomorrow is extremely important for so many of us. And as we come to the end of our time with you, we'd like you to share some closing thoughts you might have with our listeners.
Well, you know, as I sit here, I'm like most people who are listening to this thing, if they're listening to it today, is we're sitting in our homes or apartments or wherever we're quarantined, not only in the United States, all over the world. And we're trying to figure things out and where we're going to go from here. And this is what's so strange is almost, I think, almost all of our lives, I say that in a general sense, almost everybody's life, we've always sort of depended that we're going to figure out the right road. That a lot of times it just depends on your leaders, so you may know better than you. But lately, I think we've come to believe that leaders, one way or another, are trying to figure it out too. And I don't care if they're left or right. You wonder how, what they're thinking and what they're going to do. What I kind of try to see, you always try to, as a lawyer, always learn, especially as a trial lawyer, is that it's always like domino. If you want to see the end, you know, try to see if you can see down the road what's going to happen. And I can honestly say I'm probably not alone when I say down the road is very much a thought to most people. I don't care if you think we're going to have a B recovery, a U recovery, or a straight line. You don't know for sure any of it. You just can hope. And to me, it's trying to see what's going to happen, try to understand what is going to happen. The truth of the matter is, especially in the rest of us, I think a lot of it depends on people and how they react. And now we're not talking about leaders, as much as we're talking about everyday people, millions of them. What are they going to do? How are they going to react? How are they going to handle these the problems that are before us? And it's really not as much interesting enough about the leaders as it is about how they're, you know, people are going to react to what they're given. And I'm not sure how they're going to react. I'm not sure at this point, as I sit here, what they're going to be given, what choices they're going to be given. It's a thought, and it's never been like this before in my life. And I suppose I'm speaking to the choir in terms of everybody else at every level of the stratosphere of human at mankind. We're all a thought. I don't believe anybody is. And we're just going to have to see how people react all over the world to what they do next.
Well, Brother Flax, thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts with us. You provide a wonderful example for our brothers. Thank you for your support of the Zeta Beta Tau Foundation over the years and our undergraduate alumni brothers of ZBT.
And our thanks to Hunter Lang from Gamma Mu, University of Memphis 2013, for our music and production support.
And as always, it's great to be a ZBT.